Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Nicole Nixon, sitting in for Randall White. The Greater Sacramento region's stay-at-home order was officially extended over the weekend as COVID-19 case numbers continue to rise and hospital ICU capacities plummet across the state. Over at the State House, the start of the legislative session was moved back a week to January 11th due to a spike of COVID-19 cases at the Capitol. Today, we're talking about the latest coronavirus surge and the latest happenings in the California political world, including what's going on at the national level and the news of President Trump's attempt to bully a top Georgia GOP official into finding votes to overturn Biden's win in the state ahead of tomorrow's all-important Senate runoffs. We will also be joined by Assemblywoman Shirley Weber, who is poised to become the first Black woman to hold the position of California Secretary of State. You'll want to stay tuned for that. But first, we are joined by CAP Radio state government reporter Scott Rodd. He's been covering the news of the recent spike in cases at the Capitol and much more. And Scott's joining us now. Welcome.
Good morning, Nicole, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. So, Scott, today was supposed to be the first day of the legislative session of the year, but leaders postponed that gathering for another week. Was this because of the state of the pandemic generally, or did this have more to do with the growing number of cases inside the Capitol building itself?
Well, the announcement from Assembly Speaker Anthony Rendon and Senate Pro Tem Tony Atkins, they said it was because of the growing numbers generally, and the numbers looking bad in California. But at the same time, there were growing cases that were popping up in the Capitol. Just since the beginning of the legislative session in early December, there have been more than a dozen cases among folks who work in the Capitol, or among member staff, or a couple that includes a couple in the governor's office as well. And so you have these growing numbers of people in the Capitol when really it's fairly, empty right now compared to when the full legislature is reconvened. So that is kind of a barometer for determining, well, if we have everyone back, what is it going to look like, considering we have cases popping up right now when it's relatively empty? So on paper, they were saying, these cases just in general in California are increasing, but cases at the Capitol itself have also been going up.
Well, what kind of impact does moving the session back 1 week actually make? Will it matter that much in the grand scheme of things?
I had an interesting conversation with Assemblymember Kevin McCarty about this, and we talked about how, in general, at the first year of a two-year session, January isn't necessarily, the most important month. It can be a lot of procedural stuff, that a lot of big votes may not happen, but this isn't a typical year, right? We're in the midst of a pandemic. We have a looming potential eviction crisis on our hands. We have the need for more relief for folks who are hurting as a result of the pandemic and the recession. So this January actually is fairly significant for trying to get early legislation through for the folks who need relief right now. And in fact, just in the coming weeks, the eviction ban that the state established is supposed to expire. And this is something that lawmakers have already introduced legislation on, but that legislation, of course, can't move without votes happening on it. So this January actually is somewhat fairly important, and the longer you push the start date back, the smaller the window is that you have to get some important work done.
Well, on top of that, just one other complication here is the legislature has the option for remote voting, but the Senate and the Assembly, the chambers and leadership in those chambers, are sort of treating and handling remote voting itself differently. Just unpack that for us a little bit.
That's right. So the Senate sees remote voting. They're a little more lenient on it. They allow remote voting in some situations. The Assembly is a little more cautious about it. And it comes down to actually a legal question, concern over can remote voting happen constitutionally? And the concern there is if, laws are passed and even a single aspect of a law was done through a remote vote, can that be challenged in the courts? Can that hold up important legislation that was passed? We saw remote voting used in last year during the legislative session, and there weren't legal challenges, but still there is caution there.
You've been reporting, Scott, on increasing numbers of cases popping up in the state capitol. You know, memos going out to legislative staffers about positive tests more frequently. You actually learned over the weekend about a person who worked at the state capitol who recently died of COVID-19. What can you tell us about this person?
It's tremendously sad. An individual who worked in state government for about 40 years and was, you know, sort of a fixture at the Capitol. He worked in the Capitol garage. And, you know, I obtained memos from the Senate and the Assembly letting staff know. And, you know, again, just incredibly sad that someone, a member of that community, you know, had died. And just reading from the Senate memo, you know, describes him as having a cheerful attitude, his, you know, having a willingness to be a leader, and his professionalism garnered him respect with his coworkers. And so, you know, this person who folks probably saw day in and day out won't be there once the legislature reconvenes. So I think that sort of, you know, hits home just how serious, you know, this is. Of course, cases are always scary, but when you see someone who actually dies from COVID-19, that really kind of amplifies just how serious this pandemic is.
Yeah, and it sounds like this person was, like you said, a fixture at the Capitol, somebody that, you know, lawmakers and employees probably saw every day. Is there any reaction from people in the legislature you've heard of, or is there any indication that this tragic death could lead to even more restrictions at the state Capitol, which has been closed to the public for a long time?
It's unclear in terms of if this will have any impact on folks who, if this will have any impact on the start of the session. Mm-hmm. But I have heard from just in some conversations with some employees of the Capitol, just, you know, that this is, like I said before, kind of hits home. You know, this really clarifies and crystallizes just how scary this is. You know, this individual was only 58 years old. And so for a lot of folks, it just, really crystallizes just how serious the situation is.
Scott, another thing I want to talk about with you is since the election, there have been weekly demonstrations at the state capitol by pro-Trump groups. They're protesting President-elect Biden's win in the presidential race. You've been covering these events most weekends. They've been pretty tense the last few weeks. Is there anything you think that we can expect to see from these protests between now and the inauguration?
So they had actually calmed down the last week or two. And, you know, I don't know if it's folks feeling the holiday cheer or maybe, you know, some poor weather may have caused them to stay inside. But, you know, the last couple weekends were fairly quiet. But this week, it looks like there will likely be more protests, but not on the weekend. On Wednesday is the day that Congress is set to certify the election for Joe Biden. This is something that many Trump supporters object to. And so there are several planned protests that are happening at the state capitol here. And President Trump has called on his supporters to come out for protests in D.C. on Wednesday, but also in state capitals as well. So expect to likely see those protests happening. And so hopefully, you know, they remain calm and quiet compared to some of the previous ones on the weekend. But we'll see what happens.
And then just back to this latest surge of COVID-19, the Greater Sacramento Region stay-at-home order was extended over the weekend. It looked like maybe we were going to get out of that on New Year's Day, but that ICU capacity dropped to 6.9% on Saturday. So we're in it a little while longer. Do you know anything about how we come out of this? What does this mean going forward?
Sure. And actually, just to jump back to the previous response, when I said calm and quiet, I should clarify, I mean, any conflict, hopefully any conflict is minimal. But of course, you know, protests will likely go on. Right. But in terms of what it means going forward for ICU capacity in Sacramento, well, you know, the state will revisit what the capacity is. And again, it's that 15% threshold. And so if that threshold continues to be below 15%, if ICU capacity remains below that, Sacramento will have to remain in its pretty strict stay-at-home order.
I understand they look at these ICU numbers weekly and evaluate the regions based on how those numbers maybe look once or twice a week, and if it stabilizes and gets above 15%, then maybe we can come out?
That's right. You know, they do a sort of projection to see not only where we're at in the moment, but also where we're headed, if it looks like we'll be above that 15%. And yeah, and then if it stabilizes it above that 15% number, if capacity remains open, then the region can come out of the stay-at-home order. But, you know, we're not, you know, back to normal, so to speak. We'll then return to the tiered system that we were used to before, which is that color-coded system. And we'll be in, I believe, pretty much the entire Sacramento region will be in the purple tier, which is the most restrictive tier.
Switching gears, we are in a new year. There are some new laws that went into effect on January 1st. Anything stood out to you that people should be aware of now at the start of 2021?
Sure. Well, there's one, and actually you could probably speak to this one too, because I know you've been covering it. The flavored tobacco ban, I know, is an interesting law. It's something that, you know, their lawmakers had been pushing for a while. And while it was set to go into effect on January 1st, it's actually being implementation is being delayed because there's been a challenge to the law, and it looks like there will be likely a referendum on this law. And if that's the case, the implementation will be held off until that vote takes place and until it goes directly to the voters.
Mm-hmm. Anything else we should be on the lookout for in the new year, Scott?
Sure. You know, there are a couple law enforcement reform laws that have taken effect. And this last year, there were lawmakers who came out after the killing of George Floyd and after protests that happened in downtown Sacramento, you know, saying we need to take a hard look at how to improve, you know, where law enforcement reforms can take place and where we can improve relationships between the community and police. And a number of the proposals that were made had actually stalled, but some did pass. One is the option for counties to implement a sheriff's oversight board to have someone who essentially provides oversight for sheriffs and counties, and that can actually be done by the county board of supervisors, or it can go to a vote of county residents as well. And there's also a requirement now that any shootings by police of unarmed civilians will go to the state for prosecutors to investigate, as opposed to happening at the local level. That will take a little time to implement because it actually depends on a budget appropriation. So money has to be there in the budget for it to happen. So for the first maybe 6 months or so of 2021, it's expected that those cases may not be taken up by the state. But once that money is appropriated, the Department of Justice will start taking on those cases.
Scott Rodd is the state government reporter for CAP Radio. Thanks so much for joining us, Scott.
Thanks so much for having me. And again, Happy New Year.
Up next, we are joined by Assemblywoman Shirley Weber, who will become the next California Secretary of State if she's confirmed by the legislature. We'll talk about her appointment and why diversity matters in high political offices and the news of President Trump's attempt to bully a top Georgia GOP election official into finding him votes. Shoot us an email to insight@capradio.org or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You are listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Nicole Nixon, sitting in for Randall White.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm CAP Radio's politics reporter, Nicole Nixon, sitting in for Randall White today. Governor Gavin Newsom made two significant appointments late in December, promoting diverse officials and changing the power dynamics in California's two of California's most consequential seats in office and reshaping politics statewide. The first appointment was naming Secretary of State Alex Padilla to the U.S. Senate seat soon to be vacated by Vice President-elect Kamala Harris. And the second was appointing Assemblywoman Shirley Weber, a San Diego Democrat, to serve as the next California Secretary of State. If approved by the legislature, Weber would become the first Black woman to ever hold the position. And Shirley Weber joins us now. Welcome to Insight. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Good. Thanks for the invitation to be here.
So what was your reaction, Assemblywoman, when Governor Newsom announced you as his choice for the next Secretary of State?
Well, you know, the fact that I was even considered was quite an honor and really a surprise, because I did not seek the position. It was not on my radar of things to strive to become and to be a part of it. I was chairing the Black Caucus and doing the kind of work that I've done in terms of social justice and dealing with issues of diversity and those kinds of things. So it was really not on my radar as something to do. So when I was approached about it, I was really quite surprised and honored, and even more honored when the selection was made, you know, that I would become the first African-American to serve in the Secretary of State's position. And so I was really surprised, but honored at the same time.
Do you have any idea of the timeline for your transition into that office? Is that something you'll step into before the presidential inauguration or maybe shortly after?
You know, it's really quite interesting, because I think in your conversation, as I was listening to the radio, the reporting, and, you know, COVID has changed a lot of different things and therefore makes it even more difficult for us to get together to talk about the confirmation, those kinds of things that should take place. And but also at the same time, it's a domino effect. I have to wait till Mr. Padilla actually takes the Senate seat before I can take his seat. And he has to wait for Kamala Harris to vacate her seat before he can take the Senate. So it's one of those kind of things that one happens and the other one happens, and then we can begin the process of the governor calling for a confirmation, and the two houses basically organizing themselves to get the confirmation done. It shouldn't take long, but to get started is taking a while, simply because of the all the activities that are occurring around it, and of course the delayed attendance or delayed beginning of the session.
It's like a hurry up and wait type situation.
Exactly. You're absolutely correct. But there's a lot to learn in the process. So, you know, it gives us time to do that, as well as to reorganize my staff at the Capitol.
So before I get into your new role as Secretary of State and your priorities, there's this news of President Trump pressuring this top Georgia GOP official, the Secretary of State in that state, into finding votes to overturn Joe Biden's win in that state. We have some audio here. This is from The Washington Post of that phone call. Let's take a listen.
So tell me, Brad, what are we going to do? We won the election, and it's not fair to take it away from us like this. And it's going to be very costly in many ways. And I think you have to say that you're going to reexamine it, and you can reexamine it, but reexamine it with people that want to find answers, not people that don't want to find answers.
The president went on to say that Ryan Germany, who's the Secretary of State's general counsel, was making statements about the election results without being sure of them himself. And then this is what Raffensperger went on to say, the Secretary of State.
Mr. President, you have people that submit information, and we have our people that submit information, and then it comes before the court, and the court then has to make a determination. We have to stand by our numbers. We believe our numbers are right.
What do you make of that phone call between Georgia's Secretary of State and President Trump, Assemblywoman? You'll be in a position like this in just a few short weeks.
Well, let me first of all say that, you know, I was appalled to hear the conversation. I mean, my children love to look at The Godfather, and it almost sounds like something like that. The implication that you can find votes. What are you going to do? You know, we're counting on you. That you won when you really didn't win. And so all of this kind of veiled conversation was really disheartening to have it come from the highest office in the land, where voting is such an important part of this democracy. And when that is eroded and when that is destroyed, you really find yourself in a situation like so many other countries around the world where people are intimidated, people are afraid. There are all kinds of things that take place. You feel elections being repeated and repeated when in order for someone to get the result they want. That is not what we're about in this country. And so I was pleased that the Secretary of State in Georgia, he's a Republican and I'm a Democrat, but I was pleased that he remembered his oath of office. I listened to him say, you know, I took an oath to defend the Constitution. And he also said, this is not the outcome I wanted, that he wanted individually, and that this is what, but this is the will of the people. And that's the real honor and the responsibility of the Secretary of State to ensure that these elections truly are the will of the people and not the will of the Secretary of State, not the will of the governor, not the will of the president, but really the people. And we have to have that in our Secretary of State, the strength to stand up and to be basically face the wind when necessary to defend the right of individuals to do that. You know, I think one of the reasons why when I look at Governor Newsom's choice of me as Secretary of State, he understood very clearly how voting was such an integral part of my family's life. You know, not only did we know how important it was to vote, but we understood the devastation that happens when people are denied the opportunity to vote or their vote is discounted, as my family was in Arkansas. And so we see what happens when you begin to tamper with that system. And so he knew that I was a person who stood very strongly on the principles of democracy, that I stood and fought battles for justice and social justice and equality in California, and that I could not be intimidated by somebody like Donald Trump, who's going to call me about changing votes, finding him some votes, and challenging a system that had worked and had worked over and over again to validate the fact that that Georgia was won by Biden. So, I mean, you have to have the strength of your conviction. And I really applaud the Republican Secretary of State, because it's not about being a Republican or a Democrat. It's about upholding the Constitution of this country and making sure that every vote is protected and every vote counts. Not just the votes you want to count, but every vote counts. And so I was appalled when I heard that the other day. I was shocked to listen to the language, but I've been shocked many times by this administration. So this is just one of the many stacked on top of each other that we're still here having this veiled language that really is illegal and really slaps in the face of those of us who vote and who believe in the democracy and have fought across this, not only in this country, but across the world to defend the system that we have of voting and the methods in which we select our leadership.
Do you think that some people are saying that this would be an impeachable offense if Trump was, you know, not on his way out? Do you think that there should be some sort of prosecution or investigation into this?
I think what our legal persons who are thinking and looking at it should use the greatest amount of their authority to do whatever's necessary, because this really, I mean, this smacks at the heart of what this country's about. You know, I mean, I coming out of the South with my parents and understanding all the things people did to deny them the right to vote, you know, to discount their votes, to not let them vote, all those kinds of things. This is just as bad as that, but it's even worse because it comes in an environment from a president of the United States. And we've had many presidents who did not win elections, who thought they were going to win, and yet did not resort to this kind of activity. After so many lawsuits, after so many things that took place, it's not, you know, and the results have all been the same, that validates the election, that he would even go after his own party, his own persons, to try to make them once again flip and change, and the Secretary of State to do that. So, you know, I applaud the Secretary of State in Georgia for standing firm on his responsibility as a Secretary of State.
Well, I want to get back to your priorities for this office as California's next Secretary of State. What do you plan on making your priority in the next, you know, couple years before our next statewide election in 2022, right around the corner here?
Right around the corner. Well, first of all, you know, I was a part of some of the reform that has taken place in terms of the voting. I served on the elections committee. And so we were very clear about expanding opportunities for people to vote. The fact that there should be more than one way for a person to deliver their ballot, whether they wanted to mail it in or whether they wanted to have in-person voting or whether they wanted to have a voting in advance to have a time frame more than just one day. And I think we saw that, and we saw it work quite well for Californians. And we had seen that in other states, and it had increased the participation. So we've seen a turnout and a participation level that we're seeing that's increasing. That's really important. I think all of us should be pleased by that, regardless of the results, that people are expressing themselves and really returning their ballots, going to the polls early, but basically being a part of the process, because, to not be a part of the process is to allow those who are really more active and in the minority to basically run the whole system. So at least it gives everyone an opportunity to participate. So we want to continue to look at that, to see how effective that was, and to continue to implement ways in which we can do that. I also want to make the discussion of civic education and responsibility a part of what we do. And I've been approached by some of our schools, because when I hear folks like the president making the kind of comments he makes, you know, it says to somebody, it says very clearly that we have to really equip our students and our citizens to understand their civic responsibility, that they need to understand what the democracy is made of. And even when it doesn't agree with what we want it to be, that they understand why it exists the way it exists, and what happens when it begins to fail. And so I'm optimistic that we can begin to educate our kids about the various systems much more clearly, as I was educated as a kid, about the three governments that are there, and the balance of power and the relationships that exist, and what is treason and what is not treason, and how we tolerate each other's viewpoints in the world, because that's what makes democracy important. And so we're going to look at this whole issue of civic education as a part of it. That is one of the things I want to look at. Additionally, we lost a lot of small businesses, and the Secretary of State actually is in charge of licensing for small businesses. We need to begin to look at what happened during the pandemic, that a lot of small businesses failed because they didn't have the kind of support and resources and the knowledge to make a difference. So we want to make sure that we do that, as well as looking at our nonprofits. A number of nonprofits that are really important in poor communities failed because of the fact that they didn't have the right information, they didn't have the right support. And so we're looking at how we can strengthen those offices so that those entities can survive even in the midst of a pandemic.
There was some changes to voting during this last election because of the pandemic. Every California voter got a mail-in ballot. There's a bill out there now by Assemblyman Mark Berman to make that change permanent. Is that something you would support as Secretary of State?
I would support it, because I think it creates the options and the numerous ways in which people can vote. We didn't find any corruption and those kinds of things, but it really got on the minds of people that here's that I can vote, and I can vote now, or I can vote in the near future. I can basically take my ballot to a voting center or to the registrar of voters, and it became a convenient issue. And I think as we look at what is happening, we want to make voting convenient. And we've seen in other states where that's a part of the voting process, that it works, that it and people and we, they see a great turnout every election. And that's what we want. We want everyone to participate. And we've demonstrated it in this particular environment. And I guess that's the one good thing that comes out of COVID. It makes all of us look at our systems of operation differently. And we've discovered that there are some good things that we can do as a result of that.
Well, on the flip side of that, sending every person a ballot while still maintaining some in-person voting sites is expensive. And California has some tough budget years ahead with the pandemic. How would you try to convince the state legislature, the governor, to, cough up the money to keep this going in future elections?
Well, I think when they looked at the cost is there, but it's not as great as if having to have in-person voting every election and have as many voting centers set up. There's a number of things that are going to be attached to it so that the voting structure will be of such that it would be reasonable. But at the same time, keep in mind, there's nothing more important than people voting. And I've had people say, well, if you register more people, you have to print more ballots. Yes, we will. If you register more people, we'll have to print more registration cards. Yes, we will. So that's a part of the system. And if everyone goes to vote and it costs us more money for to basically have everyone vote, that is the cost of the system. And we should consider that the cost of doing good business. And we should, and so we will work to make sure the legislature understands it. And I think most of them do now after what happened with the last voting situation.
You mentioned earlier your work in the social justice, racial justice arena. Can you talk about how that would translate into your new role as Secretary of State?
Well, you know, one of the things that you learn in this whole process of social justice is that those, often people say the squeaky wheel gets the oil, that those who participate in the process of election and whose votes are looked at generally get the attention of those who are making the laws and the rules and regulations. And too often folks see issues of injustice and are afraid to vote for them because they believe that there's a larger force out there that's working against them, elected officials. And so they're hesitant to vote for social justice reform because there may be a backlash from those who vote because they don't think of people who fight for social justice as those who are actually participating and voting. So if we increase the roles of people voting from every level, then it gives an even a greater chance of having the kind of social justice reforms that are so essential that that people will look at. When I was on the school board, I would always be appalled at the fact that here I had issues that were really, really important. And people would sit there and wonder if the more affluent community is going to like this. Because why? Because they vote. And so as a result, people are much more hesitant to do these things that might have some other effect on communities. When everyone votes and everyone has a voice and everyone speaks up, then issues of social justice become a whole lot easier to provide for transformation. Because people know that those folks who are most affected by injustices are also going to go to polls and vote their interest. And so increasing the number of persons to participate in the process really increases our opportunity to do justice for every community.
We talked about sort of the domino effect of shifting seats, starting with Kamala Harris. There would be one more here, and that is your seat in the legislature. Have you thought at all about your hopes for who fills that seat next? I saw that your daughter has decided to run for it.
Yes, my daughter's been, she's in the La Mesa. She's a deputy mayor of La Mesa, and she's on the La Mesa City Council. And she's decided that she wants to run for the seat. Sometimes you think your children get close to the fire and that's enough and they'll run away from it. But instead, she's the person who embraces it. She's strong. She's very principled. She's actually a physician and fights for women's rights and women and children and families all the time. And so she wants to basically go in that seat to start talking about policy change and social justice. So she's involved in an active campaign and wants to succeed me. So I will give her all the support I can and hope that others will see that she's probably a fighter just like her mom.
Is that an official endorsement then?
Oh, I'd have to endorse it most definitely. Okay. She has my highest endorsement.
Well, we've been talking with Assemblywoman Shirley Weber, who is poised to become the next California Secretary of State. Thank you so much for joining us, Assemblywoman. We really appreciate your time today.
Well, thank you for the invitation and you guys have a great day. Stay safe.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
Well, we've been talking about the significance of Assemblywoman Weber's nomination. If approved by the legislature, she will become the first Black woman to be California Secretary of State. This nomination follows what's going on at the national level, specifically President-elect Joe Biden's cabinet, which is being described as potentially the most diverse presidential cabinet ever. This significance cannot be overstated. So what exactly does this mean? What kind of impact does diversity in high political office have on legislation and how things are run? Latrice Washington is an associate professor of American government at Otterbein University in Westerville, Ohio, and she joins us now. Welcome. Thanks for being with us. So what do you make of the appointments to Joe Biden's cabinet, Professor Washington? It's already being called one of, if not the most diverse presidential cabinets ever.
I can't hear anything.
Oh, well, we can hear you. Okay. Latrice, can you hear me? Yet? No, can't hear me. Okay. I'm so sorry. We'll take a quick break and try to figure out this audio, and we will be right back.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I am Cap Radio's politics reporter, Nicole Nixon, sitting in today for Randall White. All eyes are on the state of Georgia, where the future of the U.S. Senate will be decided tomorrow. For those that don't know, there are two races in Georgia, and voting has been going on for weeks. In both races, there's a Republican incumbent up against a Democratic challenger. The math here is very simple. Democrats have to win both runoffs in Georgia. If they do, they will get 50 seats overall and a majority in the Senate. If Republicans win either seat, they will hold on to their Senate majority. No matter what happens, the outcome will have a major impact on how much President-elect Joe Biden can get done in his first 2 years in office. And all of this comes following reports that President Trump attempted to bully a top Georgia GOP official into, quote, finding votes to overturn Biden's win in that state. Joining us now to talk about all of this and much more in the world of U.S. politics is longtime political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin himself. Welcome. Happy New Year, Ken.
Happy New Year to you, Nicole.
Okay, so these two Georgia Senate races are polling very close within the margin of error. We know that typically Republicans perform better in these types of runoff elections, but is this a typical runoff election with so much at stake tomorrow?
No, not at all. I mean, Georgia has a strange rule that if you don't get 50% of the vote on election day, the Senate races or gubernatorial races go to a runoff. No other states have that. Neither Republican Senator Kelly Loeffler nor David Perdue got a majority in November, so they're going to tomorrow's runoff. There is so much at stake. I mean, it's almost think of what a Republican Senate could do with a Democratic president. We saw with President Obama, he couldn't get his Supreme Court nominee Merrick Garland through because Mitch McConnell blocked it. If they win, as you said, if the Democrats win both, they'll get 50 seats in the Senate. That gives Kamala Harris, the vice president, the tie-breaking vote. It's very possible. This sounds like an overstatement, but it's really not. Perhaps the future of the Biden administration and the things it's trying to do is resting on tomorrow's votes in Georgia.
How likely is it that we do not know the winners in these Senate runoffs right away? I mean, it took more than 2 weeks of ballot counting in the presidential race before the Associated Press called it for Joe Biden.
That's absolutely a fair question. And not only that, of course, if it's very close, you know it'll lead to lawsuits. I mean, we haven't had enough lawsuits from November 3rd, right? But there'll be lawsuits galore if it's close. And as we saw from that horrifying phone call between President Trump and Georgia's Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, it's very possible that whether there's a genuine reason to put up a lawsuit, that doesn't mean they're not going to do it anyway. In other words, you don't even have to have real reasons to have lawsuits anymore. So So this could go on for quite a long time, and this is not what Joe Biden wants as he's about to be sworn in on January 20th.
I really wanted to ask you about this phone call, again, between President Trump and Georgia's Republican Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger. This was an hour-long call where Trump was pressuring Raffensperger to change the election results. We have a little bit of that here to listen to.
So, look, all I want to do is this. I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have, because we won the state.
Is there anything that's, well, I'm sure there's a lot. What stood out to you the most, Ken, in listening to this audio?
My goodness, Nicole, there's so much that's there. He said that he obviously won Georgia because of all the many people who went to his rallies. That is an unbelievably crazy reason to explain why you won the state, because so many people went to your rallies. Of course, Joe Biden didn't have any rallies because of the COVID precautions. The fact that he says, look, I won by hundreds of thousands of votes. There were thousands of dead people voting. And Raffensperger said, excuse me, Mr. President, we have evidence that there were only two. So there were so many things in that hour conversation, and I urge all your listeners to go to either the Washington Post website or your website, whoever has it. It's just remarkable, all the things that President Trump says that is not true. And what's even more frightening is that you have at least 11 senators on Wednesday, led by Josh Hawley of Missouri, who are going to object to the certification of Joe Biden as president, which has always been a perfunctory vote, but they're objecting to it because they say that, well, there are a lot of questions that haven't been answered. But the fact that here we are in January, still questioning whether Joe Biden won the presidency or not, he won it by 7 million votes. He won it by a sizable number in the Electoral College. All 50 states have certified their results. There's no doubt except President Trump and his supporters will keep telling people, well, it's not true. It was stolen. Dominion voting machines were rigged. It's just a very ugly display of somebody desperately trying to hold on to power in the waning hours.
Some are saying that this would be impeachable if Trump, you know, had another term or wasn't on his way out. What should happen here? Do you think there should be investigations into this phone call and perhaps prosecution?
Well, you know, I mean, of course, we know what happens in impeachment. We know that a Democratic House will impeach him and a Republican Senate will not convict him. Plus the fact you need 2/3 of the Senate to convict. So sure, you can impeach him. Sure, you can have investigations. We know that the New York Attorney General and the U.S. Attorney in the Southern District in New York are investigating Trump's business deals and financial deals. That will go on. You know, an impeachment with 14 days or 16 days to go, I mean, my goodness, just make sure that, you know, the president leaves office as scheduled on the 20th. But I would count the silverware. I would count everything in the White House when he leaves on the 20th.
I just want to ask you and underscore, because the last 4 years have been, I guess, unprecedented is kind of an understatement here with this presidency. But just the content of this phone call and the fact that the president of the United States was pressuring a state elections official in this way. Can you say something about that and how rare and sort of unprecedented this is, that this has happening?
Well, you know, Nicole, this is basically why he was impeached. He was impeached for pressuring not a Republican official in Georgia, but a Ukrainian, the Ukrainian president, saying, look, if you get dirt on Joe Biden, my likely opponent, if you can get me dirt on Joe Biden, I'll give you military aid. I mean, that was exactly why the Democratic House had him impeached. What he's doing with Raffensperger is exactly what he's done did with Ukraine. And that's basically, I want to get my way. And look, he's gotten his way throughout his career, his business deals, his failure to repay loans. I mean, that is just, you know, there's just tons of examples of that. And what he did with Raffensperger is basically, it sounds like it's radical, but according, if you watch Donald Trump's way he behaves and the way he handles things, it's not surprising at all. What's frightening is that so many, when David Perdue, the senator, Republican senator who's up for re-election, you know, in that runoff tomorrow, when he was asked what he thinks about the phone call, he said, "I thought it was a disgrace that the contents were leaked." He didn't criticize the president. He didn't criticize the president for trying to talk down the Secretary of State into fixing the election. He just didn't like the fact that it was revealed. So until the Republican Party gets a backbone and realizes that Donald Trump is not the way to is not the way that democratic regimes should be run, we're in for big trouble.
You mentioned this group of at least a dozen Republican senators who say they are going to question results from a number of states on Wednesday. This is when Congress is supposed to certify the Electoral College votes. And the Republican senators doing this could, you know, drag that process out, but it won't change the result. The fact that Joe Biden will be, you know, officially, I think this is the last step here before the inauguration, be declared the winner.
It better be.
But there are other Republicans who are skeptical of this strategy. You know, Lindsey Graham called it a political dodge. Do these divisions spell any sort of trouble for Republican unity in Congress post-President Trump?
Oh, absolutely. That's absolutely right. We saw, look, clearly Mitch McConnell told his Republican senators, do not join this folly. Do not do this. It's a waste of time. It's not going to accomplish anything. And a lot of people, you know, then, and Ben Sasse said, who's also a potential presidential campaign candidate in 2024, the Nebraska Republican, Ben Sasse said, look, what Josh Hawley and others are doing is just crazy. And it's making a laughingstock of the Republicans. But the fact that Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley and so many others, including some newly elected, said, look, our constituents demand it. And that's what it really is. If you talk to these Republican senators, many of them will say, look, Donald Trump has no case to be made. But they know that their constituents are still staying with Donald Trump, defeat or not defeat. And you turn on Donald Trump to your peril. He's already threatened primary challenges against senators in South Dakota, against the governor of Georgia in 2022, because they dare to question his strategy.
Well, NBC is reporting that Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger's office will hold a news conference today. This will be his first, you know, public statement since that controversial phone call. Any idea or any predictions about what he'll say this afternoon?
You know something? I mean, look, there was tremendous pressure. We remember when Brian Kemp, the Republican, was elected governor of Georgia in 2018 over Stacey Abrams. There were a lot of threats, a lot of accusations that Raffensperger and the governor Kemp suppressed black votes, and Republicans were cheering Raffensperger. They were cheering Governor Kemp, and now that they stood up to the president, now they're traitors. Now they're going to be hit with a primary challenge in 22. Raffensperger, give him credit. He is under tremendous pressure, not only from the president, but from the Trump voters who almost carried the state. His political future may be finished. I don't know if he could survive a primary in 2022 to get reelected. But what he's doing is standing up for democracy. And my goodness, we need heroes now more than ever. Brad Raffensperger may be one of those heroes.
Ken, we wanted to talk about diversity in Joe Biden's cabinet earlier. We had some technical difficulties, unfortunately, with Professor Latrice Washington, and we'll be sure to invite her back on the show in the future. So I want to ask you, what do you make of Biden's cabinet? It's already being called the most diverse presidential cabinet ever.
And yet not everybody is happy. And I understand that. You know, Nicole, you were talking about divisions in the Republican Party will be, you know, in the new Congress, in the new 117th Congress. There will be divisions in the Democratic Congress, too. The progressive wing, the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez wing of the party, even though she did vote for Nancy Pelosi for another term as speaker, they're saying not enough is being done for the progressives. But I will say that, you know, you have Deb Haaland as the Secretary of Interior, the first Native American in the cabinet. I mean, that is just you know, it sounds like it shouldn't be a big deal because, but it is. I mean, the Interior Department is what determines the future of Native Americans in this country. And the fact that we have our first Native American cabinet secretary in history is pretty remarkable, even though it's taken a long time. Look, it's a diverse cabinet, but not everybody will be satisfied. So we know that while the Republicans will be eating their own over Donald Trump, I suspect that the moderate wing and the progressive wing of the Democratic Party will have trouble getting together as well. This will be not a fun time for both parties in the year 2021, even though I still think it will be a happy new year.
How does Biden's cabinet compare in diversity to his predecessors?
Well, I mean, the Republicans are not known for diversity, although I will say that there are more Republican, I think there were 17 new Republican women elected to the House this year. And that is, I think, the best showing for the Republican Party in Congress in its history. So that is remarkable. But basically, Biden is trying to do what Barack Obama did and then some. I mean, Barack Obama had many history-making cabinet officials, many history-making judicial nominations. Joe Biden comes from that old school of inclusion. Look, you know, he's not going to get everything he wants. He talks about his friendship with Mitch McConnell. We'll see how great that friendship is. But Joe Biden is really caring. You know, everybody said, like, for example, when they were talking about Doug Jones as Attorney General, the white former senator from Alabama, so many progressives were saying, no, you can't have a white person doing this or a white person doing that.
Yeah, we got to leave it there, Ken. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Nicole.
That is Insight for today. Learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. I'm Nicole Nixon. Thanks so much for joining us this morning. We'll catch you tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.